Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to introduce to you now. Dr. Philip Ovadia is a board-certified cardiac surgeon and founder of Ovadia Heart Health. His mission is to optimize the public metabolic health and help people stay off his operating table. As a heart surgeon who used to be morbidly obese, Dr. Ovadia has seen firsthand the failures of mainstream diets and medicine. He realized that what helped him to lose over 100 pounds was the same solution that could have prevented most of the thousands of open heart surgeries that he has performed, which was addressing metabolic health. In his book, Stay Off My Operating Table, A Heart Surgeon's Metabolic Health Guide to Lose Weight, Prevent Disease, and Feel Your Best Every Day, Dr. Ovadia shares the complete metabolic health system to prevent disease. Dr. Ovadia grew up in New York and graduated from the Accelerated Pre-Med and Med program at the Pennsylvania State University and Jefferson Medical College. Learn more about Dr. Ovadia at www.ovadiaharthealth.com. Dr. Philip Ovadia, what an honor it is to welcome you to Balanced Body Radio.
Oh, it's great to be here with you, Casey. Real excited for this conversation today.
Absolutely. So am I. Word on the street is that you are a fantastic heart surgeon. So you've got that going for you. I do have to say, I haven't been very experienced in running a business, but I got to critique you on your business model and say, I don't think you're a very good businessman. If you're trying to keep people off your operating table, you're effectively putting yourself out of business, man. I would maybe rethink that.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I've had all the business people telling me how crazy I am. And, you know, but what I've come to realize is, you know, heart disease and the need for heart surgery is largely preventable. And I now view every heart surgery that I do, and I do continue to do heart surgery, as a failure of the medical system. And, you know, it's real important to recognize that I don't blame the patients. It's not that the patient has failed. It's that the system has failed the patient. And unfortunately, you know, the advice that we've been giving people on how to be healthy, how to stay healthy, how to get healthy has been horrible over the past 40 to 50 years. And we're seeing the results all around us. So I am on a mission to put myself out of business, as you said, and to, you know, make sure that as many people as possible don't need heart surgery.
Well, that's amazing. We absolutely love that message. We apologize in advance if we help contribute to putting yourself out of business. But on that note, I think your message is absolutely wonderful. I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast, and I've been listening to it from the very beginning. And you and your host kind of go back and forth on some of these terms, which I think is really interesting. And he doesn't have the same medical background that you do. And I kind of try to take myself back to the place that I was before I learned about low carbohydrate diets and ketogenic diets. I'm more used to it now, so I understand this message a lot better than I did. But for somebody who's never heard of any of this stuff, you can get your mind blown pretty quickly learning that this whole idea, you know, the cholesterol, the diet, the, you know, what heart disease is not exactly what we thought it was and not what we're telling people that it is. It can be pretty stunning, can it?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, realize that I had to go through that transformation myself. You know, 7-8 years ago, I was a morbidly obese, pre-diabetic heart surgeon. And, you know, I had followed all the advice that I was giving my patients. It was everything I had learned in school: eat less, move more, count your calories, eat a low-fat diet, you know, follow the food pyramid. And, you know, it took my own sort of awakening to my health challenges. And, you know, I thankfully came across the alternative thoughts around health and why we get obese and why we get unhealthy, and started applying that to myself. And I was able to fix my problems. And then I realized that these were the same things that could be helping my patients. And, you know, I had to come to that realization that, you know, I had been giving bad advice for 15 and, you know, to 20 years. I had learned misinformation, essentially, things that were wrong. And, you know, that's not to say that it was some big intentional conspiracy theory. The reality is that, you know, 50 years ago, we were facing a big problem. We had this, you know, exploding incidence of heart disease and obesity and diabetes. And, you know, the government, other, you know, entities involved made some choices about what they thought would help people. And we went down a path, but it turns out we went down the wrong path. And here we are 50 years later, and all those problems that those things we're supposed to help with, we have just seen them get exponentially worse. I mean, the you know, obesity rates, the diabetes rates have skyrocketed. Heart disease remains the number one killer in the United States and worldwide. And so it's time to step back and say, we got it wrong. And, you know, again, I started with myself and then I admitted that I got it wrong. And I've now admitted, you know, to my patients and I discussed with them that, you know, we got it wrong. The system got it wrong. And this is what we need to do to change our path.
Wow. Well, I'm super excited to unpack all of that and kind of unpack some of the myths that you talk about in your book and talk about some of the things that we understand a little bit better now. I do want to go back to your story. So what was a normal day in the life like for you before you learned about this? And then how did you come to the knowledge that the message that you were being taught wasn't necessarily the right one?
Yeah. So, you know, I think my story is pretty typical. I really was always obese, you know, at, going back to childhood. And that was despite the fact that, you know, I was a very active child. I played sports year round. I, you know, walked to school, rode my bike, you know, all over the place. And my family was largely following the dietary advice at the time. You know, we had all of the low fat, you know, margarine instead of butter and skim milk and over our, you know, heart healthy Wheaties and Cheerios and, you know, grain cereals. We didn't really have sugar in the house. My brother, my older brother is a type 1 diabetic. So we avoided sugar. You know, we ate low fat and our whole family, you know, was obese. And that just worsened as I went through, you know, the stressful time that is, you know, medical school and training to be a surgeon and, you know, a lot of long hours and poor sleep and certainly poor eating habits. And then, you know, I realized the path I was headed down and I tried a number of times to lose weight and, you know, I had some short-term successes. I would do the eat less, move more, count my calories, and I'd be able to lose some weight. And then I'd always gain it back and more. So thankfully about 7 years ago now, I started to come across some alternative thoughts. Gary Taubes was really the introduction for me. He happened to be a speaker at a medical meeting I was attending, and he had just written The Case Against Sugar at the time. And of course, prior to that, you know, good calories, bad calories, and why we get fat. And the concepts he talked about made a lot of sense. And I started following them. You know, low sugar, low carbohydrate, ultimately, you know, evolving through, you know, keto and now carnivore really for the past 3 years, I've been able to lose over 100 pounds. I've maintained that weight loss easily. I don't struggle, you know, around food anymore. And like I said, most important thing I came to recognize was this is what can help my patients. And this same bad advice that was leading to obesity and diabetes is what leads to heart disease and people ending up on my operating table.
Wow. So when you look back, I think this is something that we kind of do with people that are overweight or obese. We say, okay, we gave you the advice to move more and eat less. And maybe you didn't try that hard. Like you probably did it, but you got sick of it for a while. And then you kind of cheated. When you look back on your own life, do you think you kind of did it sort of as best you could, kind of, or were you like on it? Like you were really exercising, you were really trying to eat less, doing all the things you were actually following that advice?
Again, I think what we see there, you know, what I experienced and what most people experience is the advice itself is not sustainable. It is just impossible to significantly restrict your calories, increase your activity, you know, be at a major calorie deficit for long periods of time. You can do it for the short periods of time, and it works during those short periods of time. Again, I lost, you know, 50 pounds probably 3 times in my life. Wow. But I couldn't maintain it because it's not maintainable. It's not sustainable. Ultimately, hunger is one of the most powerful, primitive, you know, instincts we have. And you just can't fight against that indefinitely. And so we need to realize that, you know, yes, people don't follow the advice because the advice simply doesn't work and is not sustainable. And that's why we have to, you know, start thinking about different, you know, different approaches to the problem.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I spent over a decade working on a metabolic cart and doing resting metabolic assessments for people. And you could, well, first of all, you didn't need the cart to see who was doing calorie restriction or who had done it in the past, because you just recognize the body shape. You could tell they're cold, they're moody, you know, retaining weight around the midsection, even if they had lean, long, you know, arms and legs and whatever. But, you know, we confirmed it over and over again. People that did diets and did a lot of calorie burning exercising would drop their metabolic rates by hundreds of calories, and it wouldn't necessarily come back that quickly. I mean, there's that study with all the Biggest Loser contestants where they measured metabolic rates 6 years after doing the contest, and it at that point still had not come back. So you can really damage yourself that way. I do want to go back to the meeting with Gary Tobbs. It's just amazing how many people in this world have that person is like the person who taught them about all of this from the beginning. Was it pretty immediate as you were listening to him that these things were like, wow, this is really making sense. Here's all the missing puzzle pieces. Or was it just a seed that was planted that made you think like, maybe I need to study this longer?
You know, it clicked in right away for me. And, you know, the concepts he talked about made a lot of sense. You know, I literally read like all three of his books within like 4 days, you know, on the airplane home and then over the next few days. And, you know, I said, this makes a lot of sense. Everything he talks about, you know, he cites all the science and, you know, the history, you know, behind these dietary approaches. And I said, what do I have to lose? You know, everything else has failed. Let me give it a try. And I tried it and it started working and it continued working. And then I looked more into it, you know, being curious, being a physician, you know, I said, okay, you know, why haven't I heard about this before? You know, why didn't I learn about this in school? And you go back and you see that, you know, the data to support it, and you start to, you know, find all the other people who were doing it. And again, this was, you know, 7 years ago or so. It wasn't, you know, certainly as big as it is now, but you started connecting with other physicians, other scientists, other thought leaders. And, you know, again, the biggest proof was that, you know, it was working for me. And then I started giving some advice to some of my friends and family, and it worked for them. And then I started talking to patients about it, and I saw it work for them. And so, you know, that really is the ultimate proof. And, you know, but it does then reassure you that you can go into the scientific literature and you can find reasons that it works and the studies that support it. And then you just start asking those questions. Why don't we hear about it more? Why isn't this the common knowledge? And, you know, that leads you down a couple of different roads from there.
That's amazing. You must have been like absolutely jazzed after reading all that stuff and learning it and seeing the results. And I can't imagine getting into a field where you're literally saving lives. You're helping so many people. But to be frustrated, you know, with the standard advice and learning that there's an alternate way, I can't imagine the joy and satisfaction that must have provided in your practice. How was your practice changing? It sounds like it was a kind of a gradual thing as you were changing, you were starting to recommend it to other people. How did that evolve over time?
Yeah. So, you know, as exciting as it was, you know, I did have to come to that sort of moment where I was like, oh my God, the whole system around me, you know, is built on this, you know, this house of cards, you know, these lies, or this misinformation or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, I had to come to the sort of reckoning of, you know, what I was going to do. And again, when I looked deep within myself, I said, why, you know, why are you a physician? Why did you become a doctor in the first place? And the answer is to help people, the way, you know, that they need to be helped. And so, yes, doing heart surgery on people who are at that point in their life certainly helps them. But again, I realized that the real help, the even better help that I could deliver, is getting the message to the people before they ended up on my operating table. And so that's what led me to, you know, write the book and start the podcast. And I now have a telemedicine practice as well that I work with patients, you know, throughout the United States on preventative health and, you know, helping them to stay off my operating table, or even helping them recover better from being on my operating table, which is another part of it. You know, I always tell people it's never too late. Even if you've had heart surgery, we know that the natural course of heart disease is that if you've had surgery, you've had stents, you've had a heart attack, you're very likely to have more problems in the future. So making these changes can prevent those future problems.
Interesting. No, that's a perfect segue. I did want to talk to you about your book. Tell us when you decided that you needed to write this book. I'm assuming it's because you didn't find that same resource out there. And what were some of the main points that you wanted to make?
Yeah, so I wanted to bring, you know, my unique perspective, I think, to the, you know, to the arena, my combination of my personal and professional experience around, you know, obesity, heart disease, diabetes, these chronic medical conditions. And I just, you know, realized that I can only work with people one-on-one so much. I can only communicate, you know, with people, you know, in limited amounts. And, you know, I needed to find a way to get this information into the hands of more and more people. And I thought the book would be a good avenue for doing that. And the other thing I wanted to do with the book was to make the information accessible to people. You know, there are pretty, you know, kind of detailed scientific, clinical, you know, books on these topics. But that's not what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to distill the information in such a way that it really would be accessible to the people who can benefit from it. I wanted to, you know, discuss these myths that, you know, both doctors and patients have been led to believe over the years, and then give people the practical tips that they need to be able to implement these changes and get the benefits that I and so many others have gotten from, you know, these lifestyle changes.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That message definitely comes through really easily in your book and your writing style. I think anybody could really hold it and appreciate it. Before we go any further to some of the myths, we might end up jumping around to different things. Like we'll talk about obesity, we'll talk about, you know, type 2 diabetes, we'll talk about heart disease, obviously, heart attacks, all of these different things. They're like all, you know, across the board and different places. Can you tell us a little bit why they're so related to each other and what they actually mean?
Yeah. And, you know, it really comes down to the fact that they all come from the same root cause, and that is our metabolic health. And again, this is a concept that I never learned in medical school. I never heard about, you know, in the, you know, first part of my career until I came across this information. And, you know, that was a realization that was so, you know, shocking and important to me. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, that information got out to people. And the reality is that when you look at most of the chronic diseases that plague our society, you can go down the top, you know, 10 causes of death every year in the United States. And you see that the majority of them, really 9 out of the 10 of them, are attributable to the same root cause, which is poor metabolic health. And so that's what I really centered the book around, going into what that is, how we assess it, and then what we can do to fix it.
That's great. What would be the difference in your mind between metabolic health and metabolic unhealth? Where do things go awry?
Yeah. So the basic, you know, concept is that when we are metabolically healthy, our bodies are properly utilizing the inputs that we are giving it. And that is mostly in the form of the food that we are eating. And, you know, when we are, our bodies are supposed to do 3 things with food, essentially. We use some of it for immediate energy. We use some of it to build and rebuild our tissues. And then we store some of it in case there are times when food isn't available. And so when we are metabolically healthy, those things are all in balance and our body is properly, you know, divvying up the food that we are eating. Unfortunately, our modern food environment hijacks that system, and it sets up an environment where we store too much energy and we can never tap into that stored energy. And, you know, ultimately that excess of energy in our bodies, which most of us know as fat, leads to a whole host of other problems that then, you know, leads to the diabetes and the heart disease and the cancer and the Alzheimer's disease, but it can all be traced back to metabolic health. And if we assess our metabolic health properly and we optimize our metabolic health, we can prevent these problems from occurring in the first place. And even more kind of shocking to me to discover, it was that we can actually reverse many of these problems even after they have occurred.
I still want to talk to you about that for sure. It's just such a shame. Like everything that you're describing as far as metabolic health, what an elegant and beautiful system that we have. And we think about how we have been as humans for as long as we've been humans, and that's the perfect system. So we find fats and proteins, we bring them into our body, we can restore and repair ourselves, we can use fat for energy, we can store fat for later times. Sometimes we find carbohydrates. When I go on walks in the morning, which I do every single day, I don't just see food growing out all over the place. Food doesn't just spontaneously grow. There's a few fruit trees that grow. They're very seasonal. You know, 2 or 3 weeks, you'll find some fruit there. But that's about it. And it's not like wheat is spontaneously growing and, you know, vegetables growing everywhere. That just doesn't really happen. And most natural landscapes are like that. And you think like, okay, well, this system works in the context of us being human. And we just, it's 2022. We've just changed our food system so much. It's not like carbohydrates are bad per se. It's just that we're living in a world where they're way more prevalent all the time, you know, 365 days out of the year than they were before.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, and I oftentimes kind of go back to the evolutionary record for my truths. And you say, you know, humans were really working just fine for millions and millions of years. And something happened within the past, you know, 100 years roughly, and then especially within the past 50 years. And, you know, human genetics do not change over that short of a time period. The only thing that changed is our environment, and specifically our food environment. And we saw just more and more, you know, distance being placed between us and our food, and more steps, you know, in how the food gets to us and how it gets processed. And, you know, we end up in a situation where it's pretty clear that the more processed food you eat, the unhealthier you are going to be. And, you know, that is just undisputable. And, you know, once you get past that, once you realize that, you can have some discussion about how much animal product you should be eating and how much plant product you should be eating. And the reality is that it's going to vary from person to person. But first and foremost, you have to eliminate the processed food. We have to get back to eating whole, real food. And, you know, that's one of the major principles that I go through in the book, is just eat whole, real food.
Yeah, I love that. Let's talk about that myth in particular, the myth about diet, you know, the recommendations that we've been given. Obviously, very, very smart people at some point got together and said, this is the optimal diet we're going to recommend. American adults need 6 to 11 servings of bread and rice and pasta. Clearly, they had, you know, nutritional backgrounds, and they studied this for a really long time, and they came up with the absolute very best diet for us. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's not quite how it happened, as it turns out. But, you know, I certainly would have thought the same thing. But it turns out that, you know, there were basically, you know, one or two scientists who had a theory. And that theory really starts with, you know, saturated fat, you know, in the diet was leading to the high incidence of heart disease. And that theory got advanced. And basically, it was decided that we needed to take saturated fat as much as possible out of the diet. And in order to do that, you have to start messing with the food, because, you know, saturated fat is something that occurs naturally in our food environment. And so you start processing the food and you take saturated fat out and you put other things in, mostly sugar or fake fats, processed fats that have been, you know, created by the food industry. And, you know, again, it was a theory, and the test has been running now for 50 years, and the results are an abject failure. You know, we are way more unhealthier than we were at the beginning of this experiment. And so it's time to go back and say the basic assumption that saturated fat in the diet is what's leading to heart disease is what was wrong. And, you know, now we have to figure out how to get ourselves out of this problem that we have, where our entire food environment is essentially, you know, killing us.
Yeah, you made such a really good point there. And I think it was probably Nina Teicholz in The Big Fat Surprise that made this point also. You didn't say saturated fat causes obesity or weight gain or any of that other stuff. You said just heart disease. And to think that heart disease that was happening primarily in, you know, middle-aged men, whatever diet was recommended across the board to every man, woman, and child, any age, any gender, whatever, but it was really only designed for one little subset of that population. It wasn't for optimal health or building muscle or reproduction or any of those other things. It was just that one little thing, not even like weight loss.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, as I said, this really started with the concerns around the increasing incidence of heart disease, you know, and then in the 1950s, a sitting president in office has a heart attack. And of course, you know, that rightly triggered, you know, the alarms. Why do we have so much heart disease? And, you know, there were a bunch of competing theories at the time. And unfortunately, you know, the one theory won out, that this was a problem with saturated fat in our diet. And, you know, we can go back and we can realize that the science that was based upon was both flawed and maybe fraudulent. But, you know, as I said, you know, what I look at now is that here we are, you know, 70 years into the experiment, the results are a complete failure. You know, what is it going to take for us to step back and say, you know, we made a mistake, we went down the wrong path, and now we have to start undoing that.
That's so apparent. You can walk to the mall or go to an airport and just look around and contrast that with like pictures from Woodstock or something. You can see we're clearly not going in the right direction. I wonder if you can comment a little bit about how the diet, you know, let's avoid saturated fat, then became something to address the obesity epidemic by saying, let's avoid all fat altogether, not just saturated fat.
Yeah, you know, and again, that's a pretty interesting part of the story, because, again, in the 1950s, when the heart disease epidemic was coming on, we didn't have an obesity problem. We didn't really have a diabetes problem. And, you know, we started making these changes, and then all of a sudden, obesity explodes, diabetes, type 2 diabetes explodes, you know, and all these other problems occur. And the answer then became, you know, we got to double down on what we're doing. We're obviously not lowering the saturated fat enough. You know, and just this whole misguided conception that, you know, the fat we eat ends up being the fat on our body. And you just see the mistakes in thinking multiply. And, you know, and then the system, as it tends to do, you know, the big locomotive is going down the track, and it's hard to turn that thing around, because, you know, the food industry responded to what the government was saying. They said, okay, you got to make, you know, we got to get the fat out of food. So the food industry said, okay, we're going to come up with all these low fat products. And, you know, the only way to make them palatable is to put more sugar in and more refined carbohydrates. And, you know, clearly that's what has led to our obesity and now diabetes problem. But it's just the system at this point isn't going to change. It's too far down the tracks. And that's why I now, you know, go to the individuals. And my goal is to get as many people as possible to realize this information, to learn this information, to make the changes for themselves. And you can't wait for the system to make the change for you.
Yeah, totally. No, that's a really good point. That the food companies being able to turn to very cheap ingredients, seed oils, you mentioned sugar, you know, flour, wheat, corn, especially tons of corn, like all of these are very inexpensive. Of course, they'd be more than willing to create shelf-stable products that, you know, claim to be heart healthy and claim to be really good for you when you walk down the grocery aisle. And everybody just thinks like, oh, this has the label of the American Heart Association. They're looking after me to get these, you know, Cheerios or whatever. And, you know, like even just now, I would just bought some chicken breasts at the store. And it's like, you walk by the vending machine, the Coca-Cola vending machine that says, balance what you eat, drink, and do. Like Coca-Cola is like really trying to make you healthy by saying like, yeah, enjoy our beverage and just make sure you go on like a 20-minute walk afterwards or something. It's ridiculous. They're trying to make money.
Yeah, exactly. And you see that, you know, messaging that has popped up all around us, you know, even the narrative of, you know, that you need to be constantly fueling your body and you need to be snacking all the time, you know, that, you know, breakfast is the most important meal of the day, a slogan invented by the food industry without any scientific data behind it. And you see this narrative repeating over and over again. And you just realize that, you know, the food industry's job, the concern of the food industry is not to make us healthy. And it's kind of strange that we ever thought that that would be the case. They literally have zero incentive to make us healthy. And quite the opposite, their incentive is to make us as hungry as possible and have us eating as much food as possible. And again, I don't blame the food industry. You know, that's just the simple fact. You know, again, we started this off discussing about what a horrible businessman I am because I'm putting myself out of business. You know, the food industry is quite the opposite. Their one and only interest is increasing the profits of the food industry. And the way to do that is to keep people hungry and, you know, feed them processed foods that have large profit margins. And so that's what they do. And why we ever thought that they were interested in keeping us healthy, you know, just that's what doesn't really make sense in the first place. And so we have to realize that it's our jobs as individuals to make ourselves healthy.
Absolutely.
And we have to start you know, building the habits that are going to support that.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you remember the commercials, like part of this complete breakfast and you have your like bowl of cereal and the skim milk and like toast with jam and like, you know, orange juice, a glass of orange juice, like perfect formula to put me completely asleep in first period class and make my grades suck. It was terrible. Absolutely horrible. Always needed snacks, always needed like granola bars between classes. Tell us a little bit about the myths behind cholesterol. You mentioned already that just because we eat fat doesn't necessarily mean that fat is going to be added to our body. But I still think a lot of people think like, if I consume cholesterol, this cholesterol, I know right where it's going right into my arteries. It's going to start to clog everything up. It's going to, you know, seal off and I'm going to have a heart attack. Can you tell us a little bit about how we started looking at cholesterol and how that evolved over time and some of the things that we thought we got right that we absolutely didn't?
Yeah. So when, you know, when you go back to sort of the early studies on heart disease and, you know, when you look at the arteries of someone that has heart disease, you see that there's cholesterol, you know, built up in the arteries on the walls. And so the logical thought there was that cholesterol caused heart disease. And so we got to a point of the diet heart hypothesis, it was called. And basically, you know, it's a two-part hypothesis. It's that the amount of cholesterol that we eat affects the amount of cholesterol in our bloodstream. And then the more cholesterol that we have in our bloodstream, the more heart disease we were going to get. And it turns out that both parts of that hypothesis are wrong. But, you know, that was the prevailing theory that won out during the day. And again, that's what led us down this path that we got down. And the reality is when you look at the, you know, you look at the data, you look at the science, you can clearly see that insulin resistance, metabolic health, you know, there are different ways to measure it, is a much more powerful predictor of your risk of heart disease than elevated cholesterol, specifically elevated LDL cholesterol is. And, you know, again, the data on that is clear. You know, we have study after study that shows this, and yet the medical, you know, the healthcare system has all been built around this concept that, you know, high cholesterol, high levels of LDL cholesterol specifically in our bloodstream are what leads to heart disease, and that, you know, the foods that we're eating are what is affecting our LDL cholesterol. And so you either have to change the foods that you're eating, or of course you have the option of taking medications to lower your LDL cholesterol. But again, that has been the prevailing theory for many, many years. Statin medications to lower LDL cholesterol have been the number one prescribed class of medications now for 20 plus years, and we are not seeing an impact on heart disease. So you have to step back and say, one of our basic assumptions must be wrong.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think if you or I to go out into the street and ask anybody, like, tell us about cholesterol, tell us about your latest panel, I think most people would say, like, yeah, my total cholesterol was high. My doctor wanted it to be lower. One of these cholesterols is bad, and that definitely needed to be lower. And there's a good kind, and that needs to be better. But I don't know how to even do that. Nobody seems to know. Can you comment a little bit about that, where people know that there is a good version of cholesterol and then there's this evil, bad version of cholesterol? Are they the same? Are they different? Is there different, you know, ill-willing cholesterol molecules out there? Like, what's the difference?
Yeah, no, it really, again, that basic kind of distinction doesn't really make sense. You know, so again, even stepping further back, you have to ask yourself, why would our bodies make something that's trying to kill us, essentially? Because that's what the cholesterol theory really is based upon, that our bodies are making this LDL cholesterol, this bad cholesterol, and this bad cholesterol is then, you know, leading to heart disease and killing us. And, you know, at a basic level, you have to say, why would our bodies make it if it wasn't good for us? And so when you start to think about those basic questions, you know, that leads you to step back and say, okay, you know, what does cholesterol actually do in our bodies? And the answer is, you know, it's actually a repair mechanism. And the blood vessels in our heart and elsewhere get damaged, and the cholesterol gets sent to repair the damage. And then if you keep damaging the blood vessel wall and you keep sending more and more cholesterol, yes, eventually it's going to build up and you know, cause blockages. But the answer to that isn't to get rid of the cholesterol. The answer is stop doing whatever is damaging your blood vessel walls. And it turns out that the thing that's damaging our blood vessel walls is insulin resistance, poor metabolic health, high blood glucose levels, all of these other things around metabolic health. And so if we were to address that problem, the cholesterol becomes a non-issue.
Yeah, I love the analogy of, like, if you were an alien and you showed up on our planet and you noticed that somebody's house is on fire and you saw these firefighters running around, you would probably say, like, what are these bastards doing? Like, get these guys out of here. Every time I see a fire, I see firefighters, so get rid of the firefighters. And it's very similar with cholesterol, correct? Like, it's there to fix things and help things get better and heal.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that analogy as well. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, I think probably the first person I heard that analogy from was Dave Feldman, who is a computer scientist engineer. And, you know, it was another one of those aha moments, you know, sort of in this journey where I said, you know, he's exactly right. That makes a lot of sense. You know, I verified it. I went back, I looked at the studies and the science and, you know, the information that he talked about. And then I started saying, you know, why am I learning about the true cause of heart disease from a computer scientist, you know, instead of all the, you know, medical school professors and all my fellow, you know, heart doctors? And, you know, it just leads you down that path of another part of the theory that we got wrong and all of the secondary effects, I would say, of that theory.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like you. I'm just so grateful for people like that. The journalists, you know, Nina, Gary, all of these guys who they're not in the medical field. They're not in the nutrition field. They're trying to tell a story. They're trying to uncover information. The researchers, the scientists, you know, people like Ben Bickman, he doesn't care whether people eat a steak or a salad or pasta. He's just doing really good research on insulin. People like you mentioned, Dave Feldman, he's a software engineer that had this really wonky test that came back after he's feeling amazing on a ketogenic diet, but his LDL is through the roof and his doctor's pissed because his cholesterol is way too high and he's going to die of a heart attack, leads him to start asking questions. And it's so cool to see those people helping to change the message. And you're absolutely right. It has to be done at an individual level on the ground. It can't be done from the top down because it simply won't. It's like you've commented before, the entire medical system would collapse.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I came to realize through all of this is that, you know, it took the people outside the system to start asking these questions and start searching out these answers because the system itself is so broken and is so captured. And, you know, as a physician, you really get educated in such a way that you're not supposed to question these basic assumptions anymore. And again, it's pretty ironic because, you know, physicians are supposed to be educators. They're supposed to be curious. They're always supposed to be asking, you know, what can I do better, you know, to help the people that I am serving? And we have evolved to an environment, to a system that actively discourages independent thought from physicians anymore. And, you know, the nutrition part of it is certainly, you know, it's one of the most glaring examples, but you really can see it throughout medicine, throughout healthcare. And it's really what leads you to the basic problems, you know, that we see throughout our healthcare system today.
Yeah, definitely. You've already mentioned a medication, a statin in particular. Can you tell us a little bit about what some of the downsides are of a statin medication, how it can, you know, maybe help some people, but by and large can cause a lot of side effects? We understand that every medication, you know, that you can prescribe, really any chemical might have some type of a side effect, but what is it specifically about statins? It's just so important because you're right. This is the number one prescribed drug in the world, as far as I understand.
Yeah. So, you know, again, realize that, you know, when statin medications were developed, you know, they were tested sort of, I would say, you know, along in a similar way to most medications. And these are short studies, you know, a couple of years at the most, 5 years, where they, you know, see what they're supposed to do and then what other effects they might have, the side effects and the complications that can come from the medication. And one of the issues with statins is that we are now in a situation where people are being started on these medications younger and younger. And so they're taking them for longer and longer periods of time. And, you know, we now have people who have been on these medications for 20 and 25 years. And that is not a situation that was ever studied. And it turns out that there are some concerning signals that we're starting to see around these medications. You know, one of them is that there certainly seems to be worsening insulin sensitivity, higher incidence of type 2 diabetes in people who are on statins for extended periods of time. And again, we go back and we know that insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes are the biggest risk factors for heart disease. So if you're trying to prevent heart disease with a medication that's giving people the biggest risk factor for heart disease, that becomes a bit of a problematic situation.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I want to be clear that I'm not saying that no one should be on statins, and I'm not telling everyone that's on a statin medication right now to throw it out and stop taking it. What I really encourage people to do is to really, you know, to have a conversation with your physician about what is the real benefit to this medication to me? What are the real potential harms of this medication to me? And if your doctor can't have that conversation with you, which quite honestly, most physicians can't, then you need to seek out other sources of information. You need to seek out other physicians to work with. Because the bottom line is most physicians don't think about cholesterol. All they know is that if your LDL cholesterol is above a certain number, they need to prescribe a statin. And they don't think about it anything more than that. And that, I think, is the biggest you know, problem that we have created in the system around the whole cholesterol narrative. Because it turns out that the cholesterol story is a lot more complicated than that. And it really takes a lot of effort to understand this as a physician and to, you know, get through the noise and figure out what's really going on. And most physicians just don't have the time or the knowledge base to have that conversation with patients. So that's where the biggest problem I see around statins is that no thought goes into the decision as to whether or not we should start these medications and then whether or not we should be continuing people on these medications for long periods of time.
That's very well explained. I think that's some really great advice that people could take to their doctor and just at least start the conversation so they can at least get some good information, if not from their doctor, from somebody else. I do want to talk a little bit about the other side of the equation. It's so ubiquitous. Again, just like cholesterol, the whole cholesterol story, it's so ubiquitous that people just know that if they want their heart to be healthy, you have to do cardio. You have to do aerobics. You have to, you know, on that exercise front, you have to do a heavy amount of, you know, treadmill work or ellipticals or biking, whatever it is. Can you tell us some of the things that you've learned in your journey as far as exercise and quote unquote cardio and quote unquote aerobic exercise?
Yeah. So, you know, when you look at the basic question around exercise, you have to say, you know, what is your goal for exercising? And most people, their goal for exercise is to lose weight, it turns out. And unfortunately, exercise is a lousy way to try and lose weight. We have, again, plenty of scientific studies that show that exercise is not an effective tool for weight loss. But there are other benefits to exercise, clearly. And most, you know, the most important benefit to exercise, I think, is building and maintaining muscle mass. And again, we have very good studies, very clear data. This is something that I think very few physicians would argue with, that the more that you are able to build and maintain muscle mass as you age, the longer you will live and the better quality of life you will have, you know, throughout your lifespan. So that's where I try and refocus people around exercise and activity. I say your goal should be to build and maintain muscle first and foremost. So that, of course, comes down to resistance exercises. These can be body weight exercises. These can be, you know, lifting weights. These can be using resistance bands, whatever, you know, whatever suits your sort of life situation. After that, you know, if you want to do cardio, you know, there are some benefits to it. But, you know, realize that it's not essential. Again, this whole concept that we need to be in the gym for hours a day, where does that come from? It comes from the fitness industry, because you can go back to, you know, the 1950s before we had gyms on every corner and people were a lot healthier than they are today. So, you know, it's hard to believe that lack of gym is what's led to us becoming so unhealthy.
I mean, people back then weren't even jogging. They did. That wasn't even like a word at the time. Like, and you know, within one generation, everybody just started thinking they needed to be exercising all the time. I always found that it was the calorie tracker on the elliptical or the treadmill that was so enticing for somebody. You know, it's January. I'm trying to do better with my health. I can go to this area of the gym that tells me that I burned 500 calories if I do it, or I can go to that area of the gym and it doesn't tell me anything. And it kind of pulls people in that direction when really you're going to have the opposite effect. It's the muscle mass that's going to be burning more calories and more fat for you all the time around the clock versus just whatever you're doing in the gym today on that other side of the gym with the cardio. I don't care what you do. Don't do any of it if you don't want. The benefit comes from the other side where you're going to teach yourself to burn more calories and fat all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, it taking a step back, you know, this is all based on that calories in, calories out, you know, which is a flawed concept to start with. So, you know, the fact that we were led to believe that we can, you know, burn off all these calories in the gym on these activities, and then therefore we could eat more, essentially. Again, we see that just fails over and over again. The main, you know, message that I give people around activity is kind of exactly that. Just get more activity. You know, walk throughout the day, you know, walk up the stairs instead of taking the elevator, you know, try and use a stand-up desk or some, you know, all of these little things that you can do to get activity throughout your day are going to be much more effective than, you know, spending 1 hour in the gym on the treadmill or the exercise bike and then sitting around for the other 23 hours of the day and doing nothing. Yeah. And so that's the mistake that I, you know, see people making over and over again. And again, why are they doing that? It's because they've been told that that's the way to be healthy. And you have to look at where that messaging is coming from. And you have to look at the results that we've gotten from that messaging.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. And I really love the advice of like starting where you are and start with something small. It was probably 10 years ago that step trackers were starting to get a little bit more popular and we were doing contests in the gym. And I started parking at the far end of the parking lot just so I could, you know, get a few more steps. And I soon realized that became a habit and I haven't stopped. And it's been 10 years of doing that. Imagine how many more steps, how much more time in the sunlight, how much more movement, how much less time I spend battling for a parking spot at the front of the story. Like you can avoid all of it. And it's starting with those really simple things that then create a habit that you won't even notice anymore. They become really enjoyable.
Yes. And that's, you know, really what it comes down to. One of the other concepts I talk about in the book is that you need to look at your health as a system and not as a goal. And, you know, it's about building these habits that are going to support your health for the long term, rather than focusing on the short term goals that really end up not getting you where you want to be.
Yeah. So interesting. I think most people at this point could probably stand to hear that a cardiac surgeon is including some meat, some cholesterol, some animal products in their diet. I would hope that people would be open enough to that. I wonder what most people would think when they heard that their cardiac surgeon is eating only animal products and meat and fat. It sounds like you and I have been doing the carnivore diet for about the same length of time. I started in April of 2019. So it's been about 3 years. It was a 30-day experiment for myself that I enjoyed so much I forgot to get off of it. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience with the carnivore diet, how you found it, and what things you noticed from it?
Yeah. So as you said, I kind of came across it a similar time about 3 years ago. I heard what I thought at the time was a crazy orthopedic surgeon by the name of Sean Baker talking about this carnivore diet. At this point, I had been, you know, kind of very low carb, kind of keto, I guess you would call it, for many years, and it was working well. But, you know, again, it was that same thing. I said, you know, this guy sounds crazy. And then I said, well, maybe he's not so crazy. Let me look into it a little bit. And most importantly, let me try it. You know, what do I have to lose? 30 days. I'll eat, you know, only meat, and I'll eliminate the, you know, what was actually a pretty small portion of my diet, you know, at the time, of other stuff. And I went on the carnivore diet, and I immediately noticed the elimination of inflammation. At the time, I had been struggling with plantar fasciitis. No matter what I did, all the physical therapy, stop running, you know, use different shoes, all that stuff, I couldn't get rid of the plantar fasciitis. I started the carnivore diet. And again, it wasn't my goal to get rid of plantar fasciitis. I just said, let me see what happens. And my third day on the carnivore diet, I got out of bed. And for the first time in years, my foot didn't hurt when I took those first steps of the day. And it never came back again. And so I said, pretty interesting. And then I, just got into what you said, that it's just such an easy thing to maintain. I didn't really have to think much about food anymore. I was hungry less often. You know, I was able to easily eat just once a day for the most part. And the shopping's easy, the preparation's easy, all of it's easy. So I have maintained it for, you know, 3.5 years now or so as well. Importantly, though, you know, what I talk about in the book and what I work with my patients on is that doesn't mean that everyone needs to be on the carnivore diet. Doesn't mean that the carnivore diet is the right diet for everyone. It's an option. And what I try and lay out in the book is that there are many options for people on how to do this. And I give people a basic framework. And I do discuss the vegan diet and the carnivore diet, and lots of things in between, paleo and keto and, you know, Mediterranean and all of these variations. And I talk about what is metabolically healthy about each option, what may not be metabolically healthy about each option. And ultimately, people need to run the experiments on themselves, and they need to figure out what works best for them. And that answer may change over time, but there is that basic framework that I come back down to, that, you know, it starts with eating whole real food, and then we'll figure it out from there.
Yeah. So practical. I absolutely love that. It's such an important point to tell people that you don't necessarily need to be on this diet forever. It's funny, like there's certain things I expect when people switch their diets. Like when somebody goes from standard American to paleo, I'd expect them to have more energy and, you know, they're feeling really good. They go from paleo to low carb. It's like, wow, you just lost a bunch of weight and you're able to keep it off and you don't get very hungry. It's when you go from like low carb to carnivore that all the weird stuff happens. Plantar fasciitis is gone. Bone spurs that I had, gone. My creaking knee. People have told me that like they could never tan their skin on their feet and now they tan perfectly. Like all of the strange things happen when you get to a carnivore diet. One of the things that I really noticed was mental clarity was through the roof, but also things like spirituality and gratitude were far greater than anything I'd ever experienced in my life. Did you notice the same for you?
Yeah, I certainly noticed that. And, you know, part of it, on some level, what I realized is that prior to, you know, carnivore diet, I spent a whole lot of mental energy on food. I was always thinking about what am I going to eat? When am I going to eat next? You know, what do I need to shop for? How do I prepare it? All of this stuff. And, you know, on carnivore, it really just gets simple. You know, it's just eat meat and you just shop for meat and you come home and you grab something out of the fridge or the freezer and you throw it in a pan for a few minutes and you're eating and there's no cleanup and you're done. And so, I think a lot of that other stuff, a lot of the mental benefits just come from the fact that you're not wasting all of that mental energy on food anymore, and you're not thinking about food all the time. And that frees up your mind to, you know, things like spirituality and gratitude and all of that stuff. I look at the trajectory of, my career and my life, you know, during my time on the carnivore diet, and, you know, I've started actually like three separate businesses now. And I've changed the whole way that I work as a heart surgeon. And, I've had all of this energy to put towards other things because I just don't spend the time thinking about food anymore. And that's the path. That's why I stick with the carnivore diet.
You're right. It's so inexpensive and simple to do. You'll have some interesting looking plates when you're, you know, I've got some chicken left over. I've got some ground beef. I've got some tri-tip. Let's just throw it all in a cast iron with a little bit of fat and eat it until you can't lift your fork anymore. And it's absolutely delicious and so satisfying and satiating. I love the easy part about the carnivore diet. I just got back from a bike ride with a good friend of mine who has also been on this podcast, Dr. Cameron Meyer. He works in the emergency room, and we got to talking, and he mentioned that he's really loving the podcast and he's really loving being, you know, more in the low carb space and is kind of considering carnivore. And I asked him, like, how much of this are you able to share with your patients when you're in the emergency room? And he told me, it was a little surprising, but he told me he could say whatever he wants. And he has been sharing his message a little bit more. And I told him the same thing I'm going to kind of ask you is like, what does it mean to see somebody when they're the most open and most receptive that they're probably ever going to be? They've had a massive issue of health. They're about to get a foot chopped off. In his case, for you, it could be, you know, open heart surgery, whatever. What does it mean to be able to share your information with somebody when they are like have very few options left?
Yeah. You know, I really do think I am a much better doctor today, you know, than I was 7 years ago, because I am able to have these conversations with people. I'm able to give them hope ultimately, because when you look at our healthcare system, you realize that, you know, we are basically telling people, you know, that you are going to continue to be sick, but we're going to do our best to minimize the impact from being sick. And that is really the messaging of the entire healthcare system. And now I have, you know, information. I have this tool that I can bring to patients and say, we can actually get you better. You know, we can make you healthy again. And that's empowering and that's hopeful and people respond well to it. And so I think I connect, you know, much better now with people, with my patients than I did, before I made these changes. And I just feel like I'm having much more of an impact for the patients, because I say to them, listen, you know, you need to have this major surgery. We need to fix the problem that's in front of us, but we're going to have a plan moving forward so that this, you know, has minimal impact for the rest of your life, and we can actually get you healthy again. And then I try and give them the tools to do that.
That's amazing. What an amazing message, and what an honor it is to host you here. But it's just so inspiring to see that you're out there providing that hope in what would be an otherwise very hopeless situation. Dr. Philip Ovadia, where do you want people to go to find you and find your book and connect with you?
Yeah. So the best place to connect with me is on Twitter. I'm at iFixHearts. And then you can go to my website, ovadiahearthealth.com, O-V-A-D-I-A, hearthealth.com. And all the information about my practice and the book and everything else is there as well.
That's awesome. We will link to that in the show notes. Dr. Philip Ovadia, author of Stay Off My Operating Table, thank you so very much for maybe not having the best business model, but doing something that is extremely noble and is really helping people and giving them better information when, again, they can be in a very hopeless situation. So thank you so very much for everything that you do. And thank you for sharing your message here and spending some time with us today. We really appreciate you.
Thank you, Casey. I really enjoyed the conversation.
As did I. It was an honor. And this has been another episode of Boundless Body Radio. As always, thank you so very much for listening to Boundless Body Radio. It's really inspiring and amazing to see some of the reviews that we have been getting, and also to receive so many messages and emails about how these episodes have improved our listeners' lives. And so thank you so very much. We are so happy to bring these episodes to you and provide them for free. And we really hope that they help you in your life. We have just passed two major milestones, which is absolutely mind-blowing to me. And basically, we did both of these in pretty much the exact same day. We have just passed 100,000 downloads worldwide of Boundless Body Radio, and we have just launched our 250th episode, which is absolutely amazing. Like I said, I never imagined we could reach that many people. We always want to keep you updated on things that we're doing on our website. So if you go to myboundlessbody.com, you can always see what we're up to. This month, we have a link that you can go and schedule a functional movement screen, which we do virtually over Zoom. A functional movement screen is a series of 7 different movements and 3 different clearing tests, which is designed to find weak links in the body, such as muscle imbalances and joint stability issues. It's a really great tool for discovering inefficient movement. And even if you're not experiencing pain in certain areas of your body, it's something that can prevent injury later on. Some muscles need to be stretched, some need to be strengthened, and we can help you create a plan around that so that you can stay healthy and continue to move well for the rest of your life. So again, you can go and schedule that at myboundlessbody.com. You will also see the other services that we offer. You can always schedule a complimentary 30-minute consultation with us to really chat about anything that you like. And remember, if you are enjoying Boundless Body Radio, please take a minute, give us a rating or review on Apple. It really helps get this passion project out to other people. And thank you again for tuning into Boundless Body Radio.